Radio. You are now listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC.
From the Netherlands, this is the Green Planet Monitor, voices and stories from a warm, wet planet. Today, in the heart of one of Canada's biggest cities, paradise.
Where we are is so beautiful right now. It's amazing. If I took a photograph right now, we could be out in the wilderness. It's totally amazing. Like, we're actually in the middle of a city of over 500,000 people. Steel mills and train tracks and highways.
Below a city dweller's feet, a pulsating living network.
Just an enormous underground nutrient system below our feet that's just pulsating with carbon and nutrients and consistently flowing. I think that's what people don't really understand, is just how dynamic and fluid the nutrients are inside these networks.
All around us on this living planet, clear and present danger of sliding into oblivion.
We have a phenomenon that is rare, that is relatively fast, that cannot be stopped once it's started, and that leads to a fundamental change in the nature of the system we're thinking about. And once you start thinking about these currently stable conditions flipping to alternative states, that becomes very, very worrying.
This is the Green Planet Monitor. I'm David Kattenberg. Before diving in, a request. Help us deliver this weekly package for Earth News. Subscribe at greenplanetmonitor.net. It's a living web beneath our feet. A tangled network of microscopic tubes weaving through the soil, pulsating with nutrients, tying the roots of trees and other plants into vast networks. Mycorrhizal fungi, they're called. Most plants rely on them entirely, but mycorrhizal fungi do more than just feed plants. They cycle carbon from atmosphere to soil and back again, regulating Earth's climate, and they face a host of threats. Soil scientists have come together to protect fungal networks and are calling on citizens to help out.
Well, there are clearly some roots here that I'm digging out. I'm just trying to find some that still have the finest root tips attached.
I'm Casper Beek. I'm a student at the University of Amsterdam, and I'm doing my master's thesis researching mycorrhizal networks in urban environments. We're now on the Keizersgracht, in Amsterdam, one of the canals in the center. Yeah, we're investigating how the networks of the mycorrhizal fungi in these trees look compared to the ones in more natural locations.
Yeah, so this is the stuff we are looking for, these tiny roots. So this is where the mycorrhizal fungi connect to the trees. If we would have a microscope, you might be able to see some like fungal colonization. But yeah, we will get the DNA out of these roots and then see which fungi are growing inside of the roots.
Can you introduce yourself?
Yes, of course. So my name is Vincent Merckx. I am a researcher from Naturalis, which is the Natural History Museum of the Netherlands, but I'm also affiliated to the University of Amsterdam. And we are trying to understand, in this case, these ulmus trees, how they are like linked with these mycorrhizal networks to each other and potentially to other plants.
In the Netherlands, about 23% of the species are fungi. But of course, the species on their own are nothing. It's really about networks, and nature is the ultimate networker, I think. And somebody who knows a lot about that is our next speaker, Toby Kiers, who is professor of evolutionary biology at the Free University of Amsterdam. And Toby has worked a lot on fungal networks, has also started the Society for the Protection of Underground Networks, very clever, So I'm very pleased that you're here. Please take the floor.
Great, thank you. So I co-founded SPUN, which stands for the Society for the Protection of Underground Networks, and it's a nonprofit to map and protect the Earth's underground fungal networks. So when we talk about underground fungal networks, we're talking about mycorrhizal fungi. And mycorrhizal fungi are a class of organisms that form a symbiosis with plant roots, and they forage in the soil for phosphorus and nitrogen, and then they exchange these resources for carbon from the host plant. So basically, plants are covered with these fungal networks, and they're feeding them carbon that they fix from the atmosphere, and they feed it to arbuscular mycorrhizae in the form of sugars and fats. And so the fungi can't live without this carbon, and so they rely completely on their carbon source from these roots, and in exchange they're providing phosphorus and nitrogen that allow the plants to grow big and healthy. Now there's billions of these hyphae under an acre of forest, and there's tens of billions of these hyphae under an acre of grassland. So anywhere between 30 and 50% of the living biomass of these soils is these arbuscular mycorrhizal fungi. So just to give you an idea of how massive that is, if you're to take, let's say, a hectare of grassland and lay out all of the fungal network in that hectare as one long line, it would be equivalent to about 12 million lengths of the Amazon River in 1 hectare of grassland. So again, just an enormous underground nutrient system below our feet that's just pulsating with carbon and nutrients and consistently flowing. You have to remember, these are microscopic rivers of nutrients, and they're flowing really fast. So inside a fungal network, it would feel like you are moving about 50 kilometers an hour. Basically, it feels like you're moving inside a steady-moving car, I would say. The fungi, they have to be moving carbon in one direction and phosphorus in the other. So imagine, it's sort of like you're having traffic, but like not having any lanes where you're going one way or the other, but just self-organizing these waves of resources. Essentially calculating across the entire network where to move the resources.
Some of these fungi are extremely sensitive to pollution, for example, nitrogen deposition, because they help the trees to take up nitrogen. But if there is enough nitrogen in the soil, the tree is going to say, oh, I can just get it myself. I don't need these mycorrhizal fungi. And what you see in places with high nitrogen, the mycorrhizal community is much less diverse. Yeah, you lose some of the probably more specialist species. So in that sense, yeah, we need to protect what is underground.
There's a really growing body of research that's showing just how negative deforestation can be for fungal networks. And sometimes it takes decades for these networks to recover. Fire systems, you know, there's some fungi that are amazing that are able to come right back after a fire system. But these symbiotic mycorrhizal networks are not one of those types of fungi, and they take a very long time to come back. Agricultural systems, especially conventional agricultural systems where, you know, there's tillage, there's pesticides, there's fungicides. Eventually there's just not much soil life left.
SPUN to start to map, protect, and harness these fungal networks. What we want to do is get citizens and the public and activists involved in this process. people that, you know, are interested in fungal biodiversity and are interested in going out and sampling in their own yards. In the next 18 months, we hope to collect about 10,000 samples. We want to develop the first red list, right, for fungi. You know, which ones are we most worried about? Right? I mean, for decades, we've been focused, centuries, everything is about above ground climate solutions, above ground conservation strategies. All the agendas are about what we see above ground, but they fail to recognize what's happening below ground.
Yeah, it's really exploration. You know? And it's essential. Without these fungi, the trees wouldn't be able to grow. And many of our terrestrial ecosystems would simply not exist the way we know them. So, the real challenge here is actually to get to the roots. So you have to break through the pavement, and it's intriguing. Like, there are people walking here and cars parked, but we are really walking over a living network of tree roots and fungi. There's like so much happening below our feet.
Underground networks.
Yes, underground networks, yeah.
Special thanks to Bart Brown and the Naturalis Biodiversity Center in Leiden, the Netherlands, for the audio track of Toby Kears' presentation. Learn more about mycorrhizal fungi and the underground networks they form at greenplanetmonitor.net. While you're there, subscribe. With your help, we'll keep delivering stories about planet Earth, human development, justice, and science to listen to, read, and watch. Of CO2 and other greenhouse gases has warmed Earth's surface temperature by about 1.1 degrees relative to the late 19th century at a rate of about 0.3 of a degree per decade since 1980. That rate is steadily rising. As Earth's surface warms, thermal expansion and melting ice sheets have raised sea levels by 0.2 of a meter. That rate is climbing too. Slow and steady for years to come. Think again. In a recent report, a team of scientists warn about tipping points, inflection points, where Earth warming and the destruction of Earth's living fabric become nonlinear and unstoppable, and where Earth systems start shifting to new, potentially dangerous states. 25 tipping points have been identified. 5 major ones may already have been transgressed. More could soon be tripped, triggering a cascade of amplifying feedbacks across Earth's interlocked climate system and biosphere. Globalized human economies and societies will inevitably suffer. As if all this weren't scary enough, there is no adequate global governance at the scale of the threats posed by negative tipping points, the report's authors warn. Manana Milkerite is one of them. Milkerite is a postdoctoral researcher at the University of Oslo and lead author of a chapter of the report about tipping point governance. The GPM reached Manana Milkerite in Oslo. What are tipping points?
Tipping points are specific features of what we call complex systems. The way we are using them in the report, especially when we're referring to climate tipping points or Earth system tipping points, we refer to the fact that the Earth system has major subcomponents that have what's called multiple stable states, so they can exist in very different constellations or configurations, and that under certain circumstances they can move rather rapidly and irreversibly for a certain time period from one stable state to another. So that's not a very frequent occurrence, but it is possible that it happens. And then if the conditions are right, a small change in that system can trigger what we call self-sustaining feedback mechanism. So the change process keeps propelling itself forward. That creates nonlinearity, rapid change towards the second alternative stable state. And so we have a phenomenon that is rare, that is relatively fast, that cannot be stopped once it's started, and that leads to a fundamental change in the nature of the system we're thinking about. So, for example, if you think about the Amazon rainforest, that one can change from being in its current, for a very long time, stable rainforest state towards a much drier and very different grassland kind of state. So that would be characterized by very different plant and animal life. That would be characterized by a very different hydrology and possibility for living. So these are just very different, what we call system states. That kind of flip from one state to another is possible for all the systems that we try to characterize in this report, whether it's ice sheets or ocean currents or seagrass meadows or glaciers and so forth.
And there have been 25 different tipping points identified. Some are associated with the cryosphere, with the icy surface of planet Earth, others with the biosphere, and others with ocean atmosphere circulatory patterns. Can you quickly review some of these?
So we said more than 25, I think specifically 26 different candidates for tipping processes have been identified. The report assesses many more systems and even shows us how confident we are in whether or not some of these are not tipping elements or cannot have this kind of nonlinear behavior. But yeah, so I think the key distinction here is, as you said, between cryosphere, biosphere, and kind of ocean atmosphere circulation systems. The cryosphere, we have major ice sheets and glaciers. Also, permafrost is a component of the cryosphere. So we know that our major ice sheets can undergo these nonlinear transitions between their ice sheet stage, which has been the reality on planet Earth for hundreds of thousands or millions of years, and they can go to a non-existing ice sheet state. Of course, that transition might also take a very long time, but relative to the existence of the ice sheet, that is a short period if it happens within 2,000 or 3,000 years, for example. So the ice sheets can undergo that kind of transition. Then we have in the biosphere key examples. I've given you one already. The Amazon rainforest could die back and no longer be a rainforest. We also have other forests, the boreal forests in the northern latitudes of the world. We have another important biome that's at risk already today, and that's the coral reefs in the warm water areas of around the world. And then the third major system, which is the ocean atmosphere circulation systems, there we have things like the Atlantic overturning circulation, abbreviated as the AMOC, that has been of concern. Also some more recently added systems like the North Atlantic subpolar gyre. And then in the atmosphere, we have monsoon systems that could undergo such tipping processes.
And these systems are coupled, so that if, in theory, if we exceed one tipping point, if we pass one tipping point, we enter into this cascading process where other tipping points get engaged. And all these kinds of effects cascade through not just the climate system and the living world, but through human societies and global economies.
That's right. So there's two things to distinguish, I think, and it goes back to what we started with, the fact that we're talking about systems and things are connected. So these different components of the Earth system are connected to each other in important ways, and we're still studying which ones are linked to which ones and how they influence each other. Sometimes they can have stabilizing effects on each other, but sometimes they can also, as you said, increase the risk of triggering one another. So those connections between different Earth system tipping systems are being studied in terms of cascading potentials. But then we also have the connection between these Earth systems or natural systems and human societies. And there are multiple connections, lots of them. These environmental systems provide the conditions, and currently still stable conditions, for human life, for everything we do, for how we breathe, what kinds of food we can produce, where water is available, what kinds of materials we have available to construct our settlements, where we live, actually all of our social conditions for life, how we feed ourselves, how we clothe ourselves, what we do is conditioned by the environment. And once you start thinking about these currently stable conditions flipping to alternative states, that becomes very, very worrying. So there are lots of different kinds of impacts that we anticipate from these change processes, and these impacts differ significantly depending on the tipping point or the tipping system we're thinking about. So, for example, impacts would be very different from the die-off of the coral reefs compared to the melting of ice sheets or the release of the permafrost. So different impacts are expected, but they all would be severe and possibly destabilizing for societies. So we also look into the potential of accelerating change or negative social tipping points as a consequence of Earth system tipping points.
And one of the repercussions that you talk about in your paper is the collapse of world food production in wheat production and in grain production.
So we point out that, for example, the collapse of the AMOC would significantly alter temperature and moisture availability in certain grain-producing areas of the world, and that could be global scale significance.
And the AMOC is the Atlantic?
That's the Atlantic overturning circulation, right? One of these major ocean circulation patterns that regulate temperature and moisture and storm patterns and so forth around the Atlantic. So yes, we point out that could have significant consequences for the ability to grow major staple crops around the world. That's just one example of how the impacts of these tipping processes are really severe and need to be considered at this point by our global decision makers to make sure we try to prevent them. This is really our key strategy, should be the prevention of passing these tipping points, because their impacts could be so significant, diverse, and around the world. One challenge that we have, of course, with these tipping processes is to distinguish to what extent are these impacts different from the general and well-understood impacts of climate change. We do know that tipping points can contribute to accelerating climate change itself by, for example, additional release of greenhouse gases. We're accelerating warming with some of these tipping processes. But tipping processes do have their own distinct set of impacts that differ from the well-understood impacts of climate change. And that's one reason, for example, why we are pointing to the fact that our existing governance frameworks for adaptation, for example, or for loss and damage need to be revisited and rethought in the context of our knowledge about tipping points. So we need to reassess our vulnerabilities, the exposure to tipping point impacts in different places around the world to make sure we are prepared for these impacts or potential impacts. Of course, we're hoping that we can still prevent these processes from happening, but to the extent that they do come to pass, we need to be prepared. We need to increase the resilience of our societies, adjust our systems accordingly, and then deal with those consequences. And that might, as I said, require different approaches than we currently have in place, because these current plans and frameworks do not consider the specific risks of tipping points.
You write in your report, currently there is no adequate global governance at the scale of the threats posed by negative tipping points. There is no adequate global governance.
That's right. So currently we have a lot of institutions in the world that address climate change and other sustainability issues, but they're all designed without actually considering specifically the risks of these nonlinear large-scale tipping processes that I would suggest really require a different kind of logic or, in many cases now, adjustment of these existing institutions to account for these additional threats that are at a scale we haven't faced before. And so the institutions we have, for example, the UNFCCC, are all attempting to address the threat of climate change. And every instrument we have in that toolbox, from trying to address mitigation, so reducing greenhouse gases, to adaptation, to loss and damage, to finance, all of these need to be revisited and in many ways strengthened to address these increasing risks of tipping points. And that starts with a reconsideration of the global temperature goal. So our current global temperature goal says that we want to stay well below 2 degrees Celsius and have an aspirational additional goal to make efforts towards 1.5 degrees. But our report says we're already at this current level of warming at risk of triggering 5 tipping points. So 5 tipping points already are, or tipping elements, are in a state where they could be triggered at any moment, maybe the chance isn't that high yet, but the chance of triggering those will increase significantly once we surpass 1.5 degrees of global warming. So this is really where we're increasing the risks for these severe global scale changes with potential cascading effects. And so we're arguing strongly that 1.5 needs to be the only viable temperature goal left. We might even have to aim lower than that if we truly want to minimize the risks of passing tipping points ultimately. And we are very soon about to surpass the 1.5 degrees of warming, maybe within the 2030s. And so it really becomes imperative to rethink the mitigation pathways that allow us to draw temperatures back down to or even below 1.5 degrees. So we need to start thinking about minimizing peak temperature, minimizing the overshoot period above 1.5 degrees, and drawing temperatures back down with carbon removal technologies. So that's one set of implications, for example, for the existing governance structures that we have, that we suggest for how they can be used and adjusted to account for these specific risks of tipping points.
The term global governance seems to me to be an oxymoron. I mean, looking at the way the international community has dealt with the Russia-Ukraine crisis and the inability of the Security Council to just agree on a ceasefire in Gaza, it seems that global governance is it's almost like a contradiction in terms. Governments are, the most powerful ones are competitive, acquisitive. They seek power and money. There is no rule of law. There's rule of law for official enemies and not for our friends. And global governance seems to me to be anything but cooperative. The way governance works today in the world seems to me to be antithetical to what's required to actually, look after Earth systems.
So, of course, the starting point for any efforts to address global challenges, whether that's in the domain of conflict, international conflict between states, or in the domain of the environment, like we're looking at right now, the climate or Earth system tipping points are often placed within this domain of environmental issues. It starts from, internationally at least, from a place where we have a system of sovereign states, where every state is not bound by law like we are in national contexts. They're sovereign. They get to do within their territory, at least, what they want. And then we have developed over time systems of international relations and international institutions to address, or at least try to address, some of the problems that occur in such a system of independent countries. And that, of course, in terms of conflict, that often is a domain where resolution is the most difficult. And it follows often also different rules, and we see more cooperative approaches in other institutional domains like development or the environment. And governance, I also should say, is more, way more, at least in our definition, global governance contains more than just the relationship between states. So, for example, in the context of climate change, we have, of course, lots of institutions where countries come together as governments to try to cooperate to address climate change, like in the UNFCCC, but also in other international institutions. But then there are many more actors involved than just governments. So there are also non-state actors. There are lots of corporate and industry actors who do, to some extent, self-governance or private governance or rulemaking for industries within industries or economic actors and domains. There also are a lot of civil society actors that play an important role. Civil society actors often try to mobilize to change what countries do, but they also try to change what private and industry actors do. So there are lots of NGOs involved. Also, sometimes individuals can make a difference. So we have a huge range of actors at different scales of action that are involved in doing what we call governance, which is a term for saying collective efforts to address joint problems, to shape our collective patterns of behaviors, to create norms and behaviors and rules and regulations to fix those challenges. And sometimes those governance efforts are more successful than in other cases. But I think it's important to keep different problem domains separate and to assess how good or bad are we in making progress towards one or the other. As I said, in conflict, international conflict, violent conflict, that is a very different challenge compared to the problem we have here in terms of climate change, where we basically are trying to address the fact that the way we've built our societies and our economies has this initially unexpected but global scale impact on how the Earth system works. And it's pushing us towards different states of the Earth system that are not very conducive to social stability and human well-being. So we need to address that. And that's what we're doing within the climate regime, I think, and within the larger space of what you might call global climate governance.
See, right here, existing governance institutions and decision-making approaches need to adapt to facilitate transformational change.